This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 3rd, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 206. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature. I welcome back Sean Holman, the new Wayne Crooks Professor of Environmental and Climate Journalism at the University of Victoria. Hear Sean explain his new endeavor and why we need better media coverage of environmental issues. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or should everybody in Canada be worried about the new parking tax being imposed on Vancouverites? A new pollution tax up to $1,000 per year for gas-powered vehicles, a residential parking tax, $45 a year to park on the sidewalk outside your house, and if you're hosting guests overnight, well, they gotta pay $3. No doubt they'll use the Starbucks latte scale to try and tell us how affordable it all is. But this is from a city council that doesn't know when to say when. It's all wrapped in green, and if you don't agree with it, well, then you don't agree with saving the planet. But the assumptions are all faulty. It only blames cars and trucks, not buses, trains, planes, or freighters. And what about those people who live near the borders with Burnaby or UBC? Methinks they'll find a way to park on the other side of Vancouver's border and walk before shelling out more money to pay another tax to City Hall. The first Truth and Reconciliation Day happened September 30th in Canada, but Justin Trudeau thumbed his nose at Truth and Reconciliation. He wanted instead to have some travel and recreation. This was supposed to be a day of remembrance for those that suffered at Indian residential schools, but Trudeau skedaddled off to Tofino on a Canadian Forces charter jet to go surfing during the fourth wave of the pandemic. He had been invited to visit Kamloops, where the local tribe made world headlines last May when it said the remains of more than 200 children were detected. Who could begrudge the PM and his family from spending some time together for some rest and relaxation? But if the PM is really feeling pooped, then he only has himself to blame for the expensive and unnecessary election he called on August 15th. His father went for a famous walk in the snow before he quit politics. Maybe Justin Trudeau will just go for a walk in the sand and do the same. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Calgary's loss is Victoria's gain. Sean Holman has left Mount Royal University to go home to Victoria, the University of Victoria. He is the new Wayne Crooks Professor in Environmental and Climate Journalism. Wayne Crooks founded Integrity BC. He was the man behind the late Dermot Travis. Welcome back, Sean Holman, to the Breaker.News podcast. I started by asking Sean, why did you make this move?
I made this move because really climate change is the biggest issue of our time. It's the biggest story of our time. And if we are not addressing climate change, I'm not really sure what we're doing. And I'm not really sure what I'm doing. It's a phenomena. It is a force. It is a disaster that is going to affect all of us. And I am deeply concerned about it, like so many others are. And I wanted to be able to make a difference on this issue. And I'm lucky that I was the successful candidate for the Wayne Crooks Professorship in Environmental and Climate Journalism.
Well, what do you hope to achieve in the short term and in the long term?
Yeah, so the work that I'm doing for the Wayne Crooks Professorship will actually be structured around two major projects. We'll talk about the first one first. The first project is what I'm calling, what we're calling the Climate Disaster Project. The idea behind the Climate Disaster Project is that we are all of us, climate change disaster survivors in one way, shape, or form or another, whether we've experienced smoke inhalation, whether or not we've had to be evacuated because of a wildfire, whether or not we've had to flee our homes because of flooding, whether or not we've suffered heat stroke, heat exhaustion as a result of the recent heat wave. This makes us a climate change survivor. And we're not really embracing that identity. We don't really self-identify that way. So this project is designed to help us do that. The way it'll work is this. Project is being undertaken in partnership with 13 other post-secondary institutions across Canada. I'm really lucky to be working with so many amazing colleagues on it. University is going to be identifying a climate disaster in their region, in their locality. And students who are working on that project, supported by faculty, will then identify a population that they would like to focus on, who has been particularly impacted by that disaster. And then with the permission of that population, we will share the oral histories and stories of those individuals who have been impacted by climate change. I think this is valuable for a number of reasons. First, those stories will be part of a climate disaster survivor memory vault, which will allow people who have been affected by climate change in such profound ways to connect with one another and form community with one another. And that's really important because if we're going to get through the next 30 years, it's going to be by the skin of our teeth. And the only thing that will really save us is the creation of more equitable and resilient communities than the ones that already exist. That's not the only thing we're also going to be doing. We're also going to be looking for commonalities in those shared experiences. And on the basis of those commonalities and strands, we're going to be launching investigative projects to try and surface solutions to some of those common problems and trends that we're identifying. And what we also hope is that the Climate Disaster Survivor Project will become a virtual gathering space for all of the diasporas that are going to be created by climate change. We're going to see entire communities, and we already have seen entire communities wiped out as a result of climate disasters. And what we're hoping is that this project and the Vault itself will become a virtual gathering place so that members of those communities can reconnect with one another over great spans of time and space. So we're really excited about the project. And we think that, and we hope that it could make a really big difference when it comes to how we think about climate change and how we can survive climate change.
To cover the environment, it is key to tell the stories of people directly affected by climate change, to humanize the story. One of the stories from the heat dome in the Pacific Northwest in late June 2021 was from Walla Walla, Washington, a place famous for growing sweet onions. The heat was so intense that it cooked the onions in the fields. The reporters vividly described the smell of cooked onions in the fields, a smell we normally associate with the kitchen. They also explained how that affected the farmers financially.
Quite a vivid story, and it showed also the economic impacts to this farmer and his family, an immigrant family. It encapsulated, I think, everything that you were hoping to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really, in a lot of ways, what has been too often missing from coverage of climate change. We hear a lot about the policy implications. We hear a lot about the economic implications. We hear a lot about the implications for natural environments. And we hear a lot about the impact from a 12,000 feet level. But what we don't hear as much of is those human impacts that you're talking about and those human impacts that were surfaced by those reporters in the United States. We need more of that. We need so much more of that than we have right now, because those stories of people whose lives and livelihoods are being lost are really being lost. And I think we can do a lot to change that and build community around that shared experience so we don't feel so alone as people who are surviving climate change.
We are also seeing in urban areas or suburban areas, our municipal governments, who on one hand are saying that there's a climate emergency, but on the other hand, they're continuing on as they always did because their main source of revenue is development permits, and they're hoping to spur economic development by seeing construction of homes, and often homes in places like the Tri-Cities, the North Shore, cause deforestation and has interface with wildlife. We've seen many stories of the last few years about black bears being shot, coyotes ending up in Stanley Park. This is all connected to continuing development, and worldwide, we know that there's a problem, that there's too many people using too much energy, creating too much waste on the planet.
100%. And if we can put a human face on these experiences, if we can surface those stories and help people who are affected by those disasters surface those stories and share those stories, then we are going to be so much better positioned to survive what is to come. And what is to come is really going to be terrible. It's going to be really awful, and we're going to need to have so much more empathy for one another in that experience than we do right now.
An area that I have consistently covered throughout my career is government, politics, and also courts. We've seen corruption, for instance, and fraud, and there's been warnings. There was a 2015 United Nations anti-corruption conference, which had a session about corruption around climate change projects, whether it's shoddy buildings and highways in a local basis, whether it's fraud within carbon emissions trading or corruption in natural resource management. Mm-hmm. Those are issues too that we can't ignore, because there's a lot of money on the line here. A lot of corporations trying to build infrastructure, rapid transit, hydro dams, energy companies, packaged goods companies, and of course governments taxing and spending, and there's politicians that are hoping to, some that have their heart in the right place, others are trying to exploit this for political gain. It's a very complicated area that will need people like you helping journalists, especially younger journalists, to ask the questions and ask the right questions too.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. There is going to be so much of a greater need for accountability. But what I do worry about, and what part of this project is designed to address, is that information is really, in a lot of ways, losing its value in our society. Traditionally, we have thought of information as having two values, really, in a democracy: control and certainty. So with information, we can make better decisions about the world around us, thereby exerting control over private and public institutions, whether it's at the checkout line or whether or not it's at the ballot box. And we can also feel more certain about the world around us. We can better understand the past and present, and we can better anticipate the future. But what we're seeing is really the breakdown of control and certainty as a result of information. And we can see that every time the government experiences a scandal and there's really no reaction on the part of government, no resignation, no firing, no corrective work. And in that environment, people then look for kind of other forms of unhealthy certainty and control, such as authoritarianism and conspiracy theories, because that's what really those things are all about. So in this kind of post-truth environment, I think we also need to be thinking about information, not just as a controlling force, not just as a force of certainty, but also as a source of community. And I really do think that that sort of last C, that community that journalism can provide in an environment of increased uncertainty and lack of control, is going to be so important, right, in the coming three decades. And we've only really just started as journalists to think about the implications of that. And that's in part what the Climate Disaster Project is all about, building community through journalism.
And we're seeing the conflict manifest itself on a day-to-day basis of trying for that control, trying for that certainty as the pandemic continues to soldier on. Reporters are dealing with this every day, trying to get accurate information out of government communications offices, trying to get it through the Freedom of Information system, and trying to deal with public officials who have their own version of control and trying to get certainty for themselves. This conflict is, and this is all about medical and scientific information. And if we can't get to a point where we can satisfy our audiences with the information that they need in this forum, it raises questions about environmental issues and climate change issues, that if we can't get the information there and allow science, the best information to reach the top, that is going to be a major, major barrier for us. And you have the skills and knowledge through the Freedom of Information throughout your career. That is going to be one of your major challenges, I believe.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I do think, though, it also comes back to what is the value of information in democracies, right? And what we've seen is the extent of government secrecy in this world and the extent of lack of civic education, lack of media literacy has really impacted the value of information, the ability to use information in ways that are sort of healthy. And the ability to use information in ways that will result in a better society. And we're sort of really coming up against it. We have these big decisions to make as a result of climate change that we're really not ready for. we really, you know, aren't really equipped to make. And I really worry about that. I really worry what the implications are for that. And as someone who is a journalist, I'm always going to be in favor of information. I'm always going to be in favor of an evidence-based decision-making process. That's why we do what we do, Bob, right? Is so that people have information to make better decisions. But I think we also need to appreciate that dynamic, right? That formula, right, is really under threat. And so how can we also, as journalists, think about new ways in which to use information that help meet the needs of a post-truth environment? And what does that look like, right? What does that look like? And I think that's really going to be one of the big questions that we're going to need to consider as a profession and as a society.
Thanks again to my guest, Sean Holman, the Wayne Crooks Professor in Environmental and Climate Journalism at the University of Victoria. It was the ideal way to end the annual Right to Know Week. We need information to solve the big issues to protect the environment and to keep our families and communities safe.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Kyoto news, Japan Telecom NTT eyes remote work as norm for all 320,000 employees. NTT plans to begin decentralizing its headquarters from the capital to core cities in regional areas in fiscal 2022. The company will quadruple satellite offices to over 260 by March 2023 to make it easier for employees to choose where to work. NTT also wants to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions by fiscal 2040 and eliminate the use of paper by 2025 through digitization. In Taiwan news, Jackie Chan curse strikes Evergrande. As Chinese real estate behemoth Evergrande faces a crisis of epic proportions, some netizens are blaming its misfortunes on the Jackie Chan curse. Chan has been mocked by Chinese consumers for the long line of companies that have gone out of business or suffered a downturn in profits after hiring him to promote their brands. Companies such as Gree Electric, food company Sunnier, and Bawang Shampoo, while firms that have gone belly up include California Fitness, Fenhuang Cola, and Iduo VCD. In Vancouver, Chan endorsed Harmony Airlines, which launched in 2002 and stopped flying in 2007. In 2013, Chan endorsed the Evergrande Spring high-end mineral water product. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Portland firefighters to get bulletproof vests as risks increase. The decision to provide first responders with bulletproof vests comes during a year of record-breaking violence in Portland. The Portland Police Bureau reported 837 shootings through August, with the largest year-over-year increase in the North Precinct, where 383 shootings were reported by August 31st, a more than 100% increase from the same period in 2020. In King 5, this Seattle shipping container delivers the ultimate budget wedding. It's called Shotgun Weddings, and it's America's only shipping container wedding chapel. It's in the Georgetown Trailer Park Mall, a collection of offbeat artisan and craft businesses housed in cool retro trailers, a fresh air setting perfect for pandemic-era gatherings. Couples can hire an Elvis impersonator, longtime traffic reporter Shane Cobain, who is a short-tail relative of the late Kurt Cobain. In Czech news, deadly virus killing hundreds of deer is spreading on Vancouver Island. Adenovirus hemorrhagic disease, or AHD, was first detected last year on the Gulf Islands but has since made its way to the Big Island. The virus was first discovered in California in the 1990s. It most severely affects black-tailed deer, but mule deer, white-tailed, elk, and moose are all susceptible, especially their fawns. It spreads through nose-to-nose contact, but there is no evidence that humans, pets, or livestock are at risk. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to librarians. October is Library Month in British Columbia. Thank the folks at your nearest public library. Some call it the People's University. A tip of the hat to the friendly folks who find the facts and bring the books. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
Vaccine. I'm begging of you, please don't hesitate. Vaccine. Because once you're dead, then that's a bit too late. I know I'm trying to be funny now, but I'm dead serious about the vaccine. I think we all want to get back to normal, whatever that is, and that would be a great shot in the arm, wouldn't it?
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 3rd, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on October 3rd in 1995, the O.J. Simpson murder trial ended with the former football star found not guilty in the trial of the century? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.